You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about the decommissioning of a coal-fired power station along the Mississippi, about 15 miles south of La Crosse. Dairyland Power Cooperative announced plans recently to close its plant there in Genoa by the end of next year. It'll mark the end of a half century of continuous operation at the site. Do you live near this coal power plant, or can someone you know work at the Genoa 3 station? What's the job like? We're at 800-642-1234. Chris Hubbock covers energy and the environment for the Wisconsin State Journal. Chris, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you recently talked with Wisconsin Dairyland Power Cooperative. Why did they decide to shut down this coal-powered facility?
It's really, really largely economic. The plant is older, more expensive to operate, and in today's wholesale markets, prices just more often than not are not above the operating costs for these plants. So they're sort of forced to often run at a loss or operate really inefficiently. This is certainly not the first plant to retire. I think there've been 292 coal plants since 2015 that have shut down, and this joins a list of 78 others that are scheduled to retire by 2025. So it's really part of a bigger trend.
So this is more about efficiency than it is about a trend toward retiring coal plants and the climate.
Well, they kind of go hand in hand. I mean, it's one where the replacement, what's coming on, is often solar and wind, which are renewable, or natural gas, which, depending on who you talk to, is possibly better for the climate, maybe not. But then there is certainly that economics underpinning it. This is a plant that in 2011 was running at 80% of its capacity, which is really kind of a sweet spot for coal. Those plants are kind of like semis. They do best when they just keep running. They don't takes a lot of energy to restart them, so you don't want to slow them down and speed them up. But by 2018, I think it was only operating about 56% of capacity. So it just they end up sort of saying, you know, they're chasing the wind power, which is a lot cheaper. And so they end up filling in the gaps around that, which is just not an efficient way to run a coal plant.
Okay, so then we learned last month that regulators approved the construction of a $700 million natural gas plant in Superior, and this is being developed by both Dairyland Power Cooperative and Minnesota Power, which is based in Duluth. How is this new project affecting the decision at all to close the coal-fired plant?
I think it's hard not to see them going hand in hand. Dairyland has sort of touted the Nemadji Trail project as a key piece of their transition to more sustainable energy and diversification from, you know, Dairyland was even just a few years ago was almost 90% of their generation was coal. So they really are trying to diversify. I don't think it's a coincidence that they announced this just a week after getting approval for Nemadji Trail. And Nemadji Trail will then be a big piece of filling in some of their capacity obligations that they'll lose, you know, when they close.
So they're diversifying their mix of energy production. But what do they do during that interim period between when the coal plant is shut down and this new natural gas plant comes online?
They also just last week, there was a 150 megawatt solar farm that was approved. It's not owned by Dairyland, but they have a contract to take the power. That's in Jefferson County. That's scheduled to come online probably in late 2021. That will still leave a little bit of a gap for them, but they say they can contract for capacity. There's wholesale markets where they can contract from somebody else or do a few other things to fill in the gap.
So kind of a patchwork. Yeah, a patchwork. Chris Hubbuck is with us, covers energy and the environment for the Wisconsin State Journal. We're talking about a utilities plan to close its coal-fired power plant and build a natural gas plant in Superior. Join in 800-642-1234. So, Chris, the Genoa Station is located on the banks of the Mississippi River. Has Dairyland given any indication about what this site will do with the site or what will happen there?
Yeah, I think once they stop operations next year, they'll start decommissioning the plant, which they could take up to 3 years. I mean, these are just huge, huge concrete buildings. They do have some other things at the site. Number one, they've got some nuclear, spent nuclear fuel that's in dry cask storage. And with nothing on the horizon for the federal government to take that fuel, they're probably going to be stuck babysitting it for certainly the near future, if not indefinitely. And they also have a backup control center. Otherwise, you know, they said they're still reevaluating the site, and it potentially could end up being a site for some sort of renewable energy installation. They do have a lot of, you know, they've got substations and transmission lines coming in there. So there's a lot of infrastructure they could use if they wanted to redevelop.
And this will displace 80 people. Has Dairyland said anything about the workers in the situation?
Yeah, I mean, that's largely been the focus of their communications, is concern for the workers. They're offering, retraining programs. They say they're trying to make positions, internal positions available where possible, but their closest coal plant is up the river in Alma, which would, you know, it's a pretty long commute for somebody who lives in Genoa. I think they're very concerned. 80 jobs is a lot, especially for a small community like Genoa.
Let's bring in Jeff now in Delafield with thoughts on this. Hi, Jeff.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. My question is more of a general question, not specifically related to the Dairyland facility. But I was wondering if your guest has ever heard of any discussion of some of the more negative trade-offs with a conversion to wind and solar. For example, how much land mass or land is required to be basically devoted to solar generation to have an appreciable impact, as well as the deforestation that is required to construct large solar facilities. And there's also an article on Bloomberg News this morning where wind turbine blades are non-recyclable, and there's starting to be issues in landfills of trying to determine what to do with the blades.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Cost-benefit analysis, Chris, on alternative energies. What have you found there?
There's certainly a lot of concern about land use with solar now that Wisconsin is starting to see some large scale developments. They take up about roughly 7 acres per megawatt. So some of these really big solar farms can take 2,000 acres or more. On the other hand, when you look at more than 9 million acres of just cropland that Wisconsin has, we could pretty much replace all the coal-fired generation with solar and use less than 1% of just the cropland. And I'm not aware of anyone cutting trees to make room for these, at least not in Wisconsin. These are generally developed on open land.
Well, Chris, thank you for joining us. We appreciate it.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Chris Hubbuck covers energy and the environment for the Wisconsin State Journal. Coming up, we recap last night's State of the Union address. Stay with us. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about President Trump's State of the Union speech here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. The president delivered his third State of the Union address to the nation less than a day before the Senate is set to vote on two articles of impeachment against him this afternoon. So in the 78-minute speech, the president highlighted promises he's kept in office. He pointed to the strength of our economy. What did you appreciate that surfaced in his speech? What resonated with you? What disappointed you? How would you rate the State of the Union? Join in with your morning after reaction, 800-642-1234. Russell Berman is a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers politics. Russell, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
So the president made no mention of his impeachment trial last night in the chamber where the House had impeached him. House managers sat in the front row. What do you make of that calculation, not to make light of it?
Well, he followed the precedent, I guess, set by President Bill Clinton 21 years ago when he gave his State of the Union address while, you know, having been impeached and serving a standing trial in the Senate. He didn't really need to mention impeachment. And in a way, I think the entire speech was kind of revenge for impeachment against the Democrats. It was a speech that was designed to infuriate them. He took credit for economic gains that they would say started and were created by former President Barack Obama. He made a point of highlighting African Americans who have benefited from his policies. While they, of course, accuse him of fanning racism and actually being a racist for the first 3 years of his presidency, he gave a Presidential Medal of Freedom to Rush Limbaugh, who is basically the talk radio enemy of Democrats for the last 20 or 30 years. And of course, you saw in the response from Democrats, Nancy Pelosi, after the president appeared to snub her for a handshake, she fairly dramatically ripped up his speech while still on camera just as he was concluding it. So you could see all of the tensions laid bare by impeachment, even if he didn't mention it directly.
You mentioned there the policies directed at African Americans, his support for historically black colleges, school vouchers comes up, opportunity zone tax breaks for investment in low-income neighborhoods. What do you make of his focus there?
Well, I think he's clearly trying to cut into the African American vote, which goes, depending on the election, either 90% or 95% to Democrats. It's, a core of their base. And he's obviously not going to win the African American vote in this election. But if he could get even a few more percentage points, then that could be decisive. I mean, even in the state of Wisconsin alone, of course, which was one of the three tipping point states in 2016. There was a drop off in turnout among African Americans, especially in Milwaukee. Trump would like to either keep it that way or perhaps get some of them to turn out for him. And even if he again gets just a little bit more support in that community, that could be the difference.
He spent a good deal of time focused on our economy. He touched on job growth with what he said were historic unemployment rates for African Americans and other minorities, the stock market, wage growth.
America's enemies are on the run. America's fortunes are on the rise, and America's future is blazing bright. The years of economic decay are over.
So tell us there more about what the president had to say about the economy.
Well, he basically said it's the best it's ever been in American history. He said then leading into the State of the Union is stronger than it's ever been. This is a president who does admittedly like to exaggerate. So, of course, take all of that with a grain of salt. But the economy is the best thing that he's got going for him as he heads into 2020. It is strong. The Democrats can say, and they have said, that it is not working for all Americans, and certainly there are problems that they want to fix. The economy is more than the stock market, but even beyond the stock market, the economy has been fairly robust. And generally, when the economy is going well, presidents win re-election. Now, of course, Trump, despite the economy, is still hanging in the mid-40s and losing in most head-to-head matchups against his possible Democratic opponents. But he's got to really hammer home the idea and make people recognize that the economy is as strong as it is, because that, you know, more than anything, is what could propel him to re-election. Now, of course, the Democrats would say with some legitimacy that much of this started in the last couple of years of the Obama administration. None of the policies, perhaps, even including the tax cut that President Trump signed, that Trump has enacted, are directly related to the economic growth that really, started in 2014, 2015, 2016, and even before then.
We're talking with Russell Berman, who writes about politics at The Atlantic. We're getting analysis on last night's State of the Union address. Did you listen to it or watch the State of the Union? What did you think of what the president had to say? What are your thoughts on the president's views of the economy and the direction our country is headed? We're at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Steve now in Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve. What are your thoughts on the speech?
Yeah, I love the speech, but what I really loved was the Democrats' reaction during the speech and after. Trump gets criticized for saying, let's make America great again, and liberals say, oh, America was never great. Now he's saying America's doing great, and they're saying he's wrong. There's nothing funnier than watching Nancy Pelosi trying to keep her dentures in because of all her anger, ripping up the speech at the end. It was just full Trump derangement syndrome on display for the whole nation to see.
Well, Steve,
I was laughing my butt off.
Steve, I want to pause there. What did we see out of Speaker Nancy Pelosi? Because she had also reached out her hand to shake the hand of the president, Russell.
He was the one who snubbed her first in that sense before the speech. But I think the reaction from Steve is exactly what the president was aiming for. He had the Democrats sitting before him. He gave a speech that he knew would infuriate them. And he was betting that no matter what their reaction, if they did something like Pelosi ripping up the speech, if they walked out, as a couple of the House Democrats at least said that they did on Twitter in the middle of the speech, it would make Democrats look petty. Here is the president proclaiming all the things that are good and going well about the country. They believe much of it is either a lie or an exaggeration or just plain cynical. But it's, to much of the audience sitting at home, they may look petulant and petty. And that's kind of the design, I think, of the speech.
Russell, stepping back for a moment, were there any moments last night that were surprising to you or unexpected in some way?
Yeah, I mean, the speech was and typical for the president, really quite a spectacle. Ronald Reagan, President Reagan, famously started the practice of inviting guests, guests of the president, guests of the first lady, who would sit in the House chamber and then be recognized by the president as he tries to either, boast about his policies or make proposals of and show people who would be affected. And President Trump did his own spin on this. I mean, he did some of that, recognizing a 100-year-old veteran of the Tuskegee Airmen from World War II and his great-grandson. But he also reunited a soldier coming home from Afghanistan with his family, sort of a surprise that you really just usually see it at baseball games or daytime talk shows. He also, of course, as I mentioned, he gave Rush Limbaugh the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Of course, Limbaugh has announced a few days ago that he had been diagnosed with advanced lung cancer. Limbaugh is, of course, one of perhaps the most divisive and polarizing people in American public life. A hero, I guess, to conservatives who listen to him on talk radio. But he has been, frankly, mean to Democrats over the last 30 years. And here is Trump presenting him in, again, a surprise with the highest civilian honor, something that, might not necessarily go to somebody like Rush Limbaugh and has never been presented during a State of the Union address. And so those things were especially surprising, kind of taking that the usual moments of recognizing people in the chamber and stepping it up a notch for a president who likes to be a showman.
For this moment in front of the cameras, did the speech take on the feel at all of a campaign rally?
It did at points. You know, you still have the setting, which is fairly formal in the House chamber and very much different than his raucous concert-like rallies that he has out across the country. But at the beginning of the speech, you had the Republicans, the Republican members of Congress chanting 4 more years, which I think nobody's ever heard, at least at that decibel level, inside the House chamber during a State of the Union speech or before a State of the Union speech. And certainly in the way that Trump presented his accomplishments and his proposals, he really was, for the most part, directing them at the Republican side of the aisle. He was playing to the base. There wasn't a ton of bipartisan moments of applause. And so it was, in that sense, more like a rally.
The Atlantic Politics reporter Russell Berman as our guide to morning after analysis on President Trump's State of the Union speech. Join in with your takeaways. What was the tone of the speech? 800-642-1234. Back for more conversation after this news update on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A quick note on our programming plans today. The Senate impeachment trial of President Trump concludes this afternoon at 3 when senators will vote on the articles of impeachment. You can hear live NPR coverage on Wisconsin Public Radio's News and Classical Network and online at WPR.org. Over here on the Ideas Network, we'll keep you up to date on the latest and we'll invite you into the conversation. Right now, we're rewinding on President Trump's State of the Union speech last night. Last night, he targeted Democrats for supporting the Medicare for All policy proposed by Senator Bernie Sanders.
132 lawmakers in this room have endorsed legislation to impose a socialist takeover of our health care system, wiping out the private health insurance plans of 180 million very happy Americans.
So how did this speech make you feel? What did you appreciate that the president hit on? Where did it fall short? We're at 800-642-1234. Russell Berman is a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers politics, and he stays with us. So, Russell, throughout the address, the president warned against socialism. He talked about the dangers of what he called a socialist takeover there. What was the impact of his talk about socialism?
Well, it certainly energized the Republican side of the aisle. This was, of course, a preview of what the fall campaign could be if Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont especially is the Democratic nominee. He is all in on Medicare for All. And the same would be true, of course, for Senator Elizabeth Warren, who is trailing him at the moment in the polls in Iowa and New Hampshire. It becomes a little bit more of a complicated argument if former Vice President Joe Biden is the nominee or Mayor Pete Buttigieg. But the point is that the president seems to relish this contrast of going up against what he would see as a far left opponent, warning of the dangers of socialism. This is straight out of the Republican and conservative playbook of the last 20 or 30 years. And then, of course, with Bernie Sanders, I mean, that it is much more legitimate as a contrast because Bernie Sanders is a democratic socialist. He does not disavow that label or that term. He explains it in a very different way and that's consistent with American history as opposed to what people might associate it with in regimes abroad like, you know, Venezuela or the Soviet Union or Cuba. But, you know, clearly the president thinks this is a winning argument for him and he may be right.
Well, let's take another call now. Mark is joining us from Stockbridge this morning. Hi, Mark. What did you hear?
Well, I'd say I heard a great speech. Proud to be an American today. I was really taken in by not only talking to the American people, this president is doing what he's saying that he's going to do, and he's helping people like myself. I mean, I'm an average person, decent job, but I will tell you, he's making changes where the people really are coming back in the fray rather than just these powerful legislators and people in Congress that just are there for the power. You could see that, in my opinion, last night after the speech with Nancy Pelosi ripping up the speech. I mean, it just, to me, I was so proud to see that God, the flag is coming back, recognizing just people. And that's what this country needs. But unfortunately, we're quite divided.
Mark, thank you for those comments. Recognizing people, Mark feels the policies have touched his life, Russell.
And, you know, certainly there's a case to be made. There are many more people like that who do believe that the president's policies have made a difference. And there are other people who are still waiting. You know, he made a promise to repeal the Affordable Care Act, and the Republicans could not do that. There are other things that he said that he would do. He said he would work to reduce prescription drug prices, and that has not happened yet, although he talked about making a push on that either this year or perhaps if he's reelected.
House Democrats chanted H.R. 3 at one point.
Right. And so this is an example of why, you know, Democrats reacted so strongly to this address. Is they have legislation in H.R. 3 that would reduce prescription drug prices. The president campaigned on this issue. He still talks about this issue. And yet nothing has happened because the Republicans in Congress in particular are still taking the position that they've taken for years, which is they do not want government interference in this marketplace. That goes against their conservative principles. Mitch McConnell, the Senate majority leader, is not particularly interested in legislation that would hammer the pharmaceutical industry. And so this is a case where the Democrats say the president has clearly broken his promises, and they don't really understand callers like the last one who would say that they've been helped, because on a range of issues, they would say that the president, another example is infrastructure. The president has talked for years about investing more than $1 trillion in infrastructure projects across the country, and nothing has come of that. And so Democrats sat through the speech, and they thought it was extremely cynical.
Russell Berman, were there instances that you saw of bipartisanship during this address?
There are a couple examples. The two big ones were the trade deal that the president just signed, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement that replaces NAFTA, or some people are calling it NAFTA 2.0. That was something that Nancy Pelosi, even in the same week as the House Democrats were impeaching the president, they were giving him arguably his biggest domestic win by passing this trade agreement. And the second one would have been criminal justice reform. The First Step Act was something that was aimed at prison reform and reducing sentences and mandatory minimums in some circumstances. And the president did sign that with Democratic support. Of course, even there is some tension, because the Democrats had tried to pass even a broader bill under President Obama, but Mitch McConnell, again, would not bring that for a vote in the Senate until he had a Republican president who was then able to take credit for that achievement.
Talking with Russell Berman, who writes about politics at The Atlantic, we are going back through the State of the Union address. How did the speech make you feel about the upcoming presidential election in November? What about policy in this speech? What stuck out to you? What are your thoughts on the president's views on immigration and crimes committed by undocumented immigrants? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So let's spend a moment on the Democratic response. It did not bring up impeachment. There was Gretchen Whitmer who gave the response. This is a governor of Michigan. Let's listen to her speech.
As we witness the impeachment process in Washington, there are some things each of us, no matter our party, should demand. The truth matters. Facts matter. And no one should be above the law. It's not what those senators say. Tomorrow, it's about what they do that matters.
So a Midwestern governor there who is really leaning into the impeachment vote. What did you see out of Gretchen Whitmer?
Well, it was a very traditional response. It was low-key. It was, frankly, not a response to the address in that it was clearly written well before the president gave his speech, and it was just about me laying out what the Democrats want their message to the country to be. Obviously, Gretchen Whitmer, who was elected in 2018, is not running for president, so it steered clear of that issue. But she brought up impeachment, and the president did not. So she was reminding people that this is going on, that he's, you know, obviously going to be acquitted later today, and trying to, in an implicit way, bring up what the Democrats hope will be a campaign liability for those Republican senators who, even if they've criticized the president's conduct in the Ukraine affair, are mostly all of them going to vote to acquit him today.
Let's look at immigration and sanctuary cities here for a moment. What did the president say about immigration?
Well, he touted his very hardline approach, border security, building the border wall. He talked about changing policies with regard to how undocumented immigrants are treated when they come across the border, in terms of ending the catch and release policy that had been the norm in years past. And he used, of course, very descriptive, explicit language in describing crimes that have been committed by undocumented immigrants. He had a family of a victim of a crime by an undocumented immigrant. And so this was a classic Trump again, and something where the Republicans responded very well. And the Democrats, I mean, they think that his policies are inhumane and racist. And I think they were, frankly, disgusted by some of the language that he used at one point when he was describing a healthcare proposal that would give a Democratic proposal that he said would give healthcare to undocumented immigrants, or illegal aliens, as he calls them. Nancy Pelosi could be seen shaking her head no and saying, no, that's not true, which frankly harkens back to a previous presidential speech to Congress when a Republican congressman actually shouted, "You lie," at President Obama when he was talking about exactly the same topic in the context of proposals that became the Affordable Care Act.
We're talking with journalist Russell Berman from The Atlantic about last night's State of the Union speech. President Trump invited 11 guests to help highlight priorities in a speech, from Army veterans to a child on a long wait list to get into a school. What did you hear in this speech? What would you rate the speech compared to previous ones? Were there moments that confused you? Were there moments that inspired you? Join in with your reaction. Still time for you. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back for more with Russell Berman in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about last night's State of the Union speech here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. President Trump spoke about lowering the cost of health care. He talked about school choice, immigration, including work on the southern border and sanctuary cities. And since the launch of his 2016 campaign, the president has railed against illegal immigration, frequently highlighting stories of crimes by undocumented immigrants to make his case. Last night,
tragically, there are many cities in America where radical politicians have chosen to provide sanctuary for these criminal, illegal aliens.
What struck you about the president and what he had to say about immigration and sanctuary cities? What do you think of the further restrictions on immigration and foreign entry into the U.S.? Still time for you, 800-642-1234. Russell Berman is a staff writer at The Atlantic, and he's our guide to the president's third State of the Union address. We're getting a reaction here this morning. Let's go back to the phones now. John in Casanova. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hi. What did you think of it?
the speech itself, I thought was very well done. What troubles me about the whole thing is how there's such a divide between the right and the left, and how they have no respect for each other and for even people that like Rush Limbaugh, who's battling cancer. It's not about your political stance at that point. It's about what's going on in people's lives, and we have to have some respect for each other and some sympathy. I'm troubled at where the moral compass of, especially the left has gone. It doesn't seem to be even on the board anymore.
John, thanks for the call. And John is saying this chasm between the parties has just gone too far, Russell.
There's widespread agreement on that point. But, you know, President Trump and the Democrats have decided for their own political purposes in most cases that it's better to either not address or to deepen that chasm for the purposes, in his case, of winning re-election, than to reach out to be accommodating, to work together. And so, you know, frankly, at least as we go toward the election, there's not much hope of that changing until maybe next year, depending on the outcome of the election and what the voters say.
The president also touched down on the Middle East, describing work to end the war in Afghanistan. He mentioned the killing of the Iranian general, Qasem Soleimani. What did we see there out of his mentions of Iran?
We started the year nearly going to war with Iran over the killing of Soleimani and the other actions that occurred around the turn of the year. And the president, you know, was very much boasting of that decision, the decision to take out before that al-Baghdadi. You know, he sees this as something that is a success of his administration. He got the United States out of the Iran deal, which, you know, many Democrats at the time also did not support when the Obama administration entered into that. But I think the president is benefiting because the two sides did sort of back off after a few days of fear that this could lead to a much bigger conflagration. And so it kind of worked out. I mean, in a sense, the president took strong action and the Iranians, retaliated, but in a very mild way. And so we were able to sort of stand down from that potential conflict.
The president touched on many different areas, pieces of his administration. Do you find that there was momentum in this speech? Will Democrats have a difficult time stopping the momentum here that came out in the speech?
I think it does put them in a difficult spot, especially with regard to the economic gains that have occurred under the president's watch. As I said, this is a pretty important metric when you look at historically whether presidents have been reelected or not. And so you look at the context of this week where, yes, the Democrats impeached the president and that will be a stain on his legacy forever. But at the same time, he is about to be acquitted by the Senate. So that will be passed. He will claim a victory in that process. You see the beginning of the 2020 election for Democrats in Iowa begin with the debacle of the vote count there. You have the turnout in Iowa was not as strong as Democrats had hoped. And so I think you could argue that if President Trump is reelected later this year, this week might have been a turning point for him. And the speech last night was, especially the visuals, you could see that where he is ebullient and the Democrats are angered to the point of literally ripping up the speech.
Let's go to Allison now in Alma Center. Hi, Allison.
Hi. I actually agree completely with that. You know, ripping up the speech last night just showed how this country is so divided, and no matter what this president does or says he's going to do, there is not going to be any work together. I know at one point in his speech, he did reach out to a Democrat. I don't remember what the point was, but he ended them, and of course, the Democrats stood up. And I commend him for that, but we need to start figuring out to reach across these party lines. That's what got him elected in the first place, as we were sick of, you know, these politics and everything being drawn so blatantly. And I thought his speech was amazing, very uplifting. You know, there should have been points where the Democrats could stand and cheer, like the Rush Limbaugh thing was very disheartening to me. The child that is battling from being, I think it was born too young or something like that in the research, you know, that there was no movement from that side. It just showed very little heart, and it was very disheartening for me.
Allison, thank you for those comments, those reflections. Russell, where does Congress and the White House go from here?
I don't know that they go very far at all, at least in this year. There's not much hope for major legislation before the election. Democrats obviously are hoping that they'll have a Democrat in the White House next year that they can work with. The president has already sort of gotten at least one piece of legislation, a couple pieces, but the most recent one was the trade deal that I mentioned that he can campaign on and say that he did work with Democrats and that he did get Democratic support for. And so while, you know, he did make a few proposals, one thing that was notable about the speech is that there weren't that many policy proposals. A lot of times we see in the State of the Union addresses, this is the time for the president to lay out what they want to do, what they want Congress to pass. You see a lot of calls to Congress to pass particular proposals. There was very little of that. The first half of the speech was boasting about the economy, and the second half was warning about the dangers of electing, essentially, without saying so directly, but the dangers of electing a Democrat next year. So
Dale, yes, from Menominee Falls was wondering why President Trump did not refer to his tax cut for the middle class. Why didn't we hear more of that?
Well, that's actually a very interesting point. He didn't talk much about that. I think, you know, that might be a reflection of polling. The tax cut was never very popular. And to a great degree, it was because much of the benefits of the tax cut actually went to the wealthy. The Democrats were successful in arguing that in the 2018 elections when they won back control of the House, and the tax cut was a big issue, as was health care. So, yes, it was interesting that the president made very little mention of that, and it suggests that maybe he's not going to make a whole lot more mention of it on the campaign trail.
Russell, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Russell Berman is a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers politics. Just ahead, we talk about audiobooks, specifically audiobooks that kids and teens will love, and how audiobooks can boost literacy skills. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.